This is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, August 21st, 2015. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and thanks so much for listening. And I hope you won't think that I'm putting the brakes on the show or stopping the news on this Friday, but I couldn't help but note that in the infantile lunacy of the presidential race right now, there was this moment yesterday of presidentialness that I almost missed. But once I saw it, I was completely mesmerized.
Well, thank you all for coming this morning.
Jimmy Carter stepped to a microphone at the Carter Center in Atlanta to tell us officially that he has cancer, melanoma, that it is spreading, and that while he was determined to fight it, he sensed he was getting closer to the end. He told us all this with grace, dignity, charm, and that authenticity I have forgotten ever had anything to do with the White House.
I just thought I had a few weeks left. But I was surprisingly at ease.
President Carter wanted us to know that he was just fine with everything. It wasn't bravery, but an enlightened notion of public service and his faith in God. He was reassuring the people of America that he was okay and that his work would go on. At one point, he even apologized for being something of a workaholic.
A number of years, Rosa and I have planned on dramatically reducing our work at the Carter Center, but haven't done it yet. We thought about this when I was 80. We thought about it again when I was 85. We thought about it again when I was 90. So this is a propitious time, I think, for us finally to carry out our long-delayed plans. So I'm going to cut back fairly dramatically on my obligations.
This one-term president who was overwhelmed by a conservative tide that swept in Ronald Reagan in 1980 and who got quickly to work in his post-presidency, spending decades helping to eradicate communicable diseases, bring peace to conflict zones, and to build homes for the poor. He said he'd heard from so many friends and loved ones since his diagnosis, and even some of the most powerful people in the world.
Former President Bush called me at one time, and then George H.W. Bush, Bush Sr., called me yesterday afternoon again. President Obama called, the Vice President called, Bill Clinton called, Hillary Clinton called, Secretary of State called. First time they've called me in a long time.
All in all, it was a performance like I've never seen. Humble, no notes. What other public figure would tell people himself something like this? Let us all in. Tell us all. It was okay. At one point, he was asked what he most wanted to see happen before he died. His answer, peace in the Middle East, something he was not terribly hopeful about now, and the eradication of the guinea worm infection that was once a scourge for millions in the tropics, now, because of the work of the Carter Center, almost gone.
And I would like to see guinea worm completely eradicated before I die. I'd like for the last guinea worm to die before I do.
Imagine being able to name that as an accomplishment at age 90. Carter certainly had problems during his presidency. He jokingly suggested that if the hostage rescue choppers hadn't crashed in Iran, he would have had a second term and would have liked that. But mostly he said he was thankful. Thanking us for his great life.
You know, I've had a wonderful life. I've had thousands of friends, and I've had an exciting and adventurous and gratifying existence. So I was surprisingly at ease, much more so than my wife was. but now I feel, you know, that it's in the hands of God, whom I worship, and I'll be prepared for anything that comes.
And then he just stood up and said goodbye. See you when I see you. His greatest personal struggles ahead of him, the 39th president of the United States, slipped out a door and was gone to have his first radiation treatment. This man who was the first Southern president in generations, who came into office when the South was new again, leaves us all to think about duty, service, and humanity. It was the best of times. The digital economy's birth, coinciding with the birth of a new century, offered hope for a new epoch of invention, creativity, and economic success.
Enough is enough! I have had it with these snakes on this plane! Everybody strap in!
It was the worst of times. Snakes on a Plane, the mediocrity blockbuster formula that eventually brought us films like Sharknado. And in this worst of times intellectual future, there would be no need to burn books. Nobody would even remember what they were.
We'll take these books.
Okay. You're going to come back, aren't you?
Of course.
Books, what are those? In the future, they'll be called Landfill. It was a time of mind-bending musical success. It was a time of Napster, a formula that eventually brought us free streaming music. The spokesman for creativity itself, back in 2000, Lars Ulrich of Metallica, tried to block that digital train hurtling down the tracks.
We should decide what happens to our music, not a company with no rights in our recordings, which has never invested a penny in our music or had anything to do with its creation. The choice has been taken away from us.
But writer Stephen Johnston says these are the good times for the creative classes. He lays out his research in The Creative Apocalypse That Wasn't in this week's New York Times Magazine. Artists, he says, just have to work harder in this digital age. Anyone got a problem with that?
It looks as though there are slightly more musicians than there were in 1999, many more self-employed musicians, and they are making, on average, slightly more money than they did before. And it doesn't seem to be that the superstars are driving up the average. If you look at the kind of megastar musicians, they're making about the same, adjusted for inflation, of course, as their, you know, equivalents were 15 or 20 years ago. So it seems as though the average musician is doing okay. And for whatever reason, there seem to be more musicians than there were 15 or 16 years ago.
So Taylor Swift is doing better, and Tyler Smith is also doing quite well.
Yeah, and again, there are individual stories in there. There are musicians who are not doing as well. The economics of the whole thing has changed. Clearly, musicians are making less money from recordings, but they seem to be making, one, a little bit more money from live music. Live music ticket prices have gone up, you know, dramatically. They've actually gone up faster, more dramatically than the prices of recorded music have dropped, which is kind of interesting. And there's also a kind of a diversifying of potential revenue streams for musicians. There's a whole host of revenue streams that just weren't around 15 or 20 years ago. So for instance, like licensing your music to TV shows or video games, that's a big business now. It basically didn't exist 20 years ago. And the other thing that's really important here, and we ignore this a lot, is all the technological factors that made it easy to pirate music make it much easier and cheaper to record music. And so it is much cheaper to record and distribute an album now than it was 15 or 20 years ago. It was hard to actually get an album recorded and get it in circulation and get it internationally distributed. Took a big label.
So if you're on a label, it's easier for you to get ripped off. But if you want to create your own label and self-publish, that's easier to do than ever.
Right, exactly. The other thing that's interesting here is to look at it next to books, because we all know that the traditional, you know, record store, the kind of Tower Records or, you know, the indie record store with, you know, all those vinyl albums, that, you know, that has largely withered away. And
you know what? My 17-year-old's birthday is today. You know what she wants?
A vinyl album record player.
A turntable, that's right.
Anyway, it's coming back. It's crazy, kids.
It's crazy.
Anyway,
yeah.
But we thought, a lot of us thought that the same thing was going to happen to bookstores, right? That the classic indie bookstore in the downtown area that was, you know, that was going to get replaced by people downloading Kindle books on their iPad or on their Kindles. And in fact, that hasn't happened at all. And the indie bookstores are doing really well. In fact, a lot of people in that community say that last year was the best year they've ever had, and they're growing in number, not declining in number. And I think that's because, just as the live music business has, you know, thrived over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, the same thing is happening with indie bookstores. In a sense, if you want community around music, you don't necessarily go to a store and buy CDs, you go to a show. If you want community around books, you go to that indie bookstore and you go to a reading or you go talk to people in the bookstore. That's where the kind of community experience of books is.
Thinking about the writer model there, can you imagine Hemingway having to blog?
Yeah, I mean, and I think this is a legitimate concern for the writing side, although the publishing business is not, you know, it's not having the kind of crisis that the recorded music business has had. But yeah, the kind of the solitary writer who wants to, you know, sit around and work on his or her, you know, masterpiece for 8 years and then release it and then be ignored. I mean, in a way, Hemingway at least courted publicity for a lot of his career. It's more Faulkner, right, who just really wanted to not exist as anything other than just his books. That role is a little bit harder to imagine. And probably if that role, you know, if we have fewer Faulkners, that's probably a loss.
What about movies?
Well, the argument that people have been making about movies is that the classic mid-budget artistic picture for adults has kind of dropped off the map, and that Hollywood has gotten, you know, just obsessed with making, you know, sequels of sequels and comic book hero movies and, you know, vampire movies. On the one hand, I think that's one place where the data supports the critics in the sense that Hollywood itself, the big Hollywood studios, something like 70% of all the movies made last year, they were top grossing movies from Hollywood, were in that category. They were either, you know, superhero franchises or, you know, movies targeted at teenagers. And so that kind of the classic Hollywood of the 70s and early 80s seems to have withered away. But in its place, interestingly, is this kind of new category of kind of the major, I was calling them in the piece, the major indies, often funded by kind of wealthy individuals from outside the kind of the film business. And they have funded a lot of great pictures that have done very well at the box office in recent years, The 12 Years a Slave and Her and The Wolf of Wall Street and so on. And so I looked again kind of statistically at this and looked at the most highly rated kind of movies in this by critics in this category and looked at how they did at the box office compared to movies in 99 and 2000 and 2001. And basically it's almost exactly the same. If you make a critically acclaimed kind of mid-budget picture, you'll make about $50 million at the U.S. box office. And that was almost exactly the same in adjusted dollars in 99 and 2000.
Huh. And I guess, you know, there's a model for that. I mean, there were, you know, rich patrons of the arts back in the old days who would support painters, who would support, you know, Mozart, who would support Haydn, you know, to do symphonies and things that just weren't able to be done in one's own studio. And maybe the movies have become a little bit like that.
Well, yeah. And the other way in which that tradition is being revived, which is really interesting, of course, is things like Kickstarter and Patreon, where instead of, you know, a single rich patron, you have, you know, 2,000 middle class patrons who each contribute $100 or $500 to or $10 to the album or the movie or the documentary that you're trying to make.
Hey, Mr. Future Dude, you know what we call that here? The pledge drive, okay?
Yeah.
Here in public radio, Kickstarter. Whoa, nice. That's
yes.
Really futuristic. We've been doing that for about 60 years, okay?
You are so ahead of the times. I totally agree.
I'm telling you.
You credit there.
There you go. Stephen Johnson is currently the author of The Creative Apocalypse That Wasn't in this week's New York Times Magazine, and author most recently of the great book, How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Play it once, Sam, for all time's sake.
Hoo-ah!
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Did you say wheat? Wheat.
Hey, what happened?
Wheat, wheat, wheat from Annie Hall, right?
Is that Annie Hall?
Yeah.
Persona, originally.
Love and Death. Love and Death.
Woody
oh, Allen.
It's Love and Death.
Rafer Guzman wins. It's Friday. We talk about movies. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Hi, guys.
Hey John.
So two thrillers this week. Is that fair to say?
Action films.
Yeah, action films. All right. Number one is American Ultra. Let's hear a clip.
Hey, babes. What's up?
Hey, I just killed two people. Two
two gentlemen.
That's awesome.
Why?
No, these two guys were trying to, like, break into my car at work, and they had guns and knives, and they were being, like, total d***.
They just attacked me.
Baby got mugged?
And then I took, like, a spoon, and I just, like, I, like, shoved it through this guy.
Did you call the police?
No, I didn't call the police, because I'm the kill guy. I'm the murderer, okay? I also have, like, I have, like, a lot of weed and, like, mushrooms in my car, and I just killed two dudes in a parking lot, okay?
Jesse Eisenberg's a little nervous there. Kristen, how did this go? How did this go for you?
He sure is nervous. So this is, by the way, the first of two movies we have this week where we have humans who are programmed to be killing machines. Jesse Eisenberg seems like he's just your typical loser stoner who doesn't really have any motivation, but he's actually, unbeknownst to him, been programmed to be a killing machine. And his girlfriend, played by Kristen Stewart, is kind of his handler. And once he is recommissioned into becoming a killing machine, we see him go from stoner to kind of an action hero. And I have to say, of the two reprogrammed human movies this week who are killing machines, this is the better of them. And it's great to see these two back together after Adventureland, like, I think 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, they don't really utilize Kristen Stewart as well as they should. That was my biggest beef with this movie. I think that most of the time she's just playing the supportive girlfriend and he gets all the fun lines. And the action's pretty good, but I think it could have been pumped up even more.
Rafer?
I actually felt there was a little too much action in this movie. I think it's supposed to be a stoner comedy, kind of like Pineapple Express. That whole kind of joke is, I'm like the world's least likely action hero, right? I'm Mark Zuckerberg from The Social Network, and all of a sudden I've turned into like a killing machine, as Kristen said. But I feel like the action is really kind of nasty and brutal, and I feel like there's something kind of tragic and anguished about this film. And I don't understand why it decided to go in that direction, sort of a Jean Le Carré direction, when what we're looking for is kind of Harold and Kumar, or like Dude, Where's My Car? And I felt it was a really strange kind of tonal misstep for this film.
Bill Pullman, John Leguizamo also in this film. Can you actually kill people with a spoon, Rafer?
He does, and a cup of noodles.
I don't really want to know why. Movie number two, Hitman, Agent 47. Let's see a clip.
He's an engineered human being. Stronger. Faster. More intelligent than normal people. His name is 47. He's here to kill you.
Now, you could have described that premise much more quickly than that trailer, Kristen.
That's Zachary Quinto actually speaking
yes.
in that movie. He's John Smith, and he's explaining why this woman who is running around being chased, why she's being chased, who she's being chased by. She's being chased by Hitman Agent 47, and I'm just going to say I'm so glad there is not a Hitman Agent 46, 45, 44, 43, 42. I would not want to see any more of these movies. I think that this is the slowest, most boring action movie I possibly have ever seen.
47 is a sinister number. You couldn't have any other number. Go ahead, Rafer.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree. It's pretty bad. It's based on a Danish video game, and it feels like one. You know, basically, you're just watching Rupert Friend, the guy from Homeland, just sort of, you know, turn this way, turn that way, shoot one guy, you know, knock the other guy's brains out over and over and over. Pretty boring. I will say, there is a character who's an Agent 90, so we've got the potential for many, many, many sequels.
On the podcast?
We're helping Joanna Solitor from The Longest Shortest Time podcast with a movie therapy question about whether or not to become a parent.
Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, both co-hosts of the Movie Day podcast. Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
You too,
you
John.
Too, John.
You know, Cuba could have been a colony of the United States, spoils of the Spanish-American War. But the U.S. claimed it wasn't interested in empire, and in 1898, Cuba joined the independent nations of the Western Hemisphere, bolstered by an invasion of U.S. dollars, 50 million of them. The U.S. investments kept coming, and by the 1950s, Cuban revolutionaries accused the U.S. of using its economic might to control Cuba and its neighbors.
Castro marks the second anniversary of his revolution with the biggest military parade ever staged in Cuba. Shortly afterwards, Castro demanded the United States Embassy drastically reduce its staff to 11 persons. President Eisenhower broke off diplomatic relations with a message read by Press Secretary Hagerty.
There is a limit to what the United States and self-respect can endure. That limit has now been reached.
In 1959, the Cold War military song of distrust and conflict replaced the decades-old sounds of Cuban mambo, salsa, and an explosion of Cuban music. see an American flag over a U.S. embassy in Cuba and a Cuban flag over a Cuban embassy in Washington, D.C., stirred up almost more hope about the future than jazz musician Arturo O'Farrell could take.
I saw two flags going up. I saw the American flag going up over the Cuban countryside, and I saw the Cuban flag going up over Washington, D.C. I felt giddy. I mean, I thought maybe I'd cry. I thought maybe there would be like a well of emotion. But I was just smiling. I was just stupidly grinning from ear to ear. I felt very privileged to see this. I did not expect to see it.
O'Farrell says there's a music and a rhythm to this new relationship. It's fast, but it won't give you whiplash unless it's a whiplash from joy itself.
There's a rhythm that I love that comes from the Oriente province in Cuba. It's called the comparsa. It's also, I mean, it doesn't just come from there, but it finds its richest expression in carnival. And it's a rhythm that is played by groups of musicians, very much like in Brazil's samba schools. But these are different rhythms. They're very Cuban. The comparsa is usually the screaming mass of people running down the street while parading, led by an instrument called the corneta china. And it's an incredible, joyful cacophony that it can't. There's no words to describe it. It's very fast, very syncopated.
How does it sound? He was born in Mexico City to a Mexican mother and a Cuban father. Chico O'Farrell was a trumpeter, band leader, and composer who formed relationships with big musicians from the United States and Puerto Rico and Cuba and incorporated African and Latin beats. As a boy, Arturo thought these sounds and these places were all just one big enchanted land of music and dance. As a young man, his blended cultural identity has become part of what drives him as a musician today. Arturo was working on an album in Havana with the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra when President Obama made his announcement about the normalization of relations with Cuba last December. For Arturo O'Farrell, everything that's gone on between Cuba and the United States in his lifetime has been heartbreaking and also stupid. He says it's like family business that's dumb and emotional, where people stop speaking for no good reason.
Cuba and the United States had a love relationship, man. It was a symbiotic love affair. What happened was very akin to finding your lover in bed with someone else. A very messy and divorce ensued. And of course, you know, that kind of betrayal is very hard for both sides, and it usually takes years, if not decades, for two betrayed partners to ever talk again. This is very much what happened. Look at Cuban culture and look at American culture and what we share. Baseball, music, the incredible amounts of culture that we share. And it was shocking. It was shocking for us to wake up one day and find that Cuba had become communist.
How did that ideology get in the way of the music, get in the way of the culture, get in the way of all the things that you loved about the common ground that the U.S. and America had? Or the U.S. and Cuba had.
I'm not so sure that the ideology ever got in the way. I think musicians have always talked. It was always my intention to show that culture trumps ideology, that what people dance, what people watch, what people paint, what people eat, what people listen to is bigger. Of course, Nelson Mandela said that if you think politics is big, try music. It's a lovely thing to look at this and say it began with Chico O'Farrell. Of course I'd love that. It didn't begin with Chico O'Farrell. Although Dizzy Gillespie and Chano Pozo were instrumental, if you excuse the pun, in beginning a new conversation about it, because they started playing together and recognized one another's music in each other. And that really began the realignment of two peoples musically.
Well, it did begin for you with Chico O'Farrell, because he's your dad,
of
and
course.
He's the band leader. And did Chico compose for a people, for a particular, I don't know, ethnicity, a particular time? Or was he really looking for something global in the way that Dizzy Gillespie was trying to create a universal music or get in touch with a universal music?
That's a great question, because I think what Chico did was be this nerdy, well-trained, extraordinarily curious man who didn't see Latin music and jazz as separate. For him, the object, and for me, and this is what I really think I inherited from him, the struggle every day is to be the best that you can be, the most creative and most visionary and progressive artist that you can. He did never rest on his laurels. If he had an opportunity to write something, he didn't write another mambo. He wrote a mambo with a serial tone row. I mean, you know.
A 12-tone
yeah,
row.
Some craziness like that.
He wrote serial 12-tone mambo.
He wrote a piece with Dizzy Gillespie called The Three Afro-Cuban Jazz Moves. No, Oro, Incienso, and Mira. And he included a tone row in that piece. I mean, this is really the aesthetic that Chico Farrell embodied. This is the aesthetic that he gave me.
So you're that nerdy guy in the 21st century.
Yeah, I'm even nerdier, man. I play the piano. At least he was a trumpet player, for goodness sake.
No comment, but I hear you. I definitely hear you. So as far as your work is concerned, in some ways, this rebonding with America and Cuba allows things to happen that hadn't happened for a while, and it also allows for the creation of new anthems of a future of Cuba and America together. What are you doing in your work? Both? Neither?
You know, it's funny. I think that the name of the album is The Conversation Continues. And for me, conversation is an ongoing fluid process. And there is a kind of an unbalance in the way that musicians, jazz musicians, view Afro-Cuban musicians and Afro-Cuban musicians view jazz musicians. And jazz musicians still look at Afro-Cuban music as somehow exotic and really syncopated and strange and hard to believe and all kinds of, you know, very almost foreign. And Cuban musicians look at jazz musicians and put them on some sort of pedestal. And it's unhealthy. Really, the truth of the matter, and what Dizzy Gillespie and John Oposa began to recognize, is that they were playing the same music, coming at it from different angles. But that the harmonic language, the concept of rhythm and swing were very much the same. And so I think one of the things that I look forward to is much more integration between Cuban musicians and jazz musicians, and that they will kind of come up with a third music that Dizzy Gillespie called universal music, something that is neither Afro-Cuban or jazz, but a completely new and progressive vision of what this music is, this improvised music that is a direct inheritance from the Afro-folkloric traditions of all of our music. It's an exciting day.
Well, you know, these are such exciting times. Did you ever get the feeling that your initiative in 2002, your decision to really go at this as an artist, to recreate this conversation and try to push it forward, helped to move diplomacy, move history? Did art move history in this case?
I completely think it did. I think that when you look at what people are motivated by, they're motivated by greed, yes. They're motivated by commerce, yes. But they're also motivated by life. I mean, culture and music, all those things are really things that we do at the end of the day. No matter how much money you make, no matter how little money you make, at the end of the day, everyone wants to chill and listen to some music. Culture trumps ideology always, and it just destroys barriers. It destroys walls. And that, my friend, is really what creates history.
There's the final question then. What's the worst case scenario for you? What, if we don't just kiss and make up here?
I would think the worst case scenario is that everything that we've begun in earnest good faith falls by the wayside, and the Cubans, who are weary, cautious of Americans to begin with, have more reason to mistrust us. I think that would be tragic. I think it'd be tragic because, believe it or not, Cubans are very cautious about this moment. They're, you know, crying in joy and crossing themselves in laughter, but they are very, very, very scared of this moment because we've all been down broken promise trails. And I think that at this point, the worst case scenario is that, you know, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but that an administration unfriendly to progress takes over the White House and all this work is undone. And I just, wow, what a tragedy that would be.
Well, write something cautious and joyful, and maybe no minor key.
No. Minor keys can be quite joyful,
yeah,
actually.
That's true. And you know how to do it way more than me.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Arturo,
that.
Thanks so much.
What a pleasure.
Arturo O'Farrell is a 2-time Grammy Award-winning musician. His new album is called Cuba. The Conversation Continues. It's out today. You want to sit in, I mean comment on this or anything you've heard on the program, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And if you want to take our program with you, subscribe to The Takeaway podcast. You can find it on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work or anywhere. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.